For 2 weeks now, Iran has been in turmoil, once again. And from Washington, there are threats. U.S. President Donald Trump says he is reviewing military options. What does this mean for the people in Iran? And what does it mean for the region?
A new balance of power between the people and the regime. A new attitude of the people towards the regime. The fact, as I said, they are not fearful anymore. Fear has shifted camp, I would say. It's now the regime, which is, some people call it a zombie, you know, basically living on his last straws. So in that sense, yes, we are seeing the last phase of the regime, definitely.
Is this the tipping point? Or will the regime once again push back, as it did in 2019, in 2022, in 2023? And would an intervention by the United States help? Or would it risk escalating the situation, possibly all the way to civil war? That's what this episode is about.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Welcome to In Crisis Mode. My name is Jan Jessen. I'm political editor and a crisis reporter for the Funker Media Group. For around 2 weeks now, people in Iran have been taking to the streets. What began as protests by bazaar merchants against rising prices and taxes, and above all against the collapse of the national currency, the rial, has turned into a nationwide uprising. In some places, it has become militant. The internet has been throttled and in many areas completely shut down. That makes it extremely difficult for outside observers to verify what is happening. All indications suggest the regime is responding with force. Videos showing burning mosques play into the hands of those in power. They speak of terrorism and foreign interference. Donald Trump, meanwhile, has hinted that the United States could intervene if violence continues. We'll start by hearing from the opposition and then turn to an expert assessment. Our first guest is Shahin Gobadi. He is a spokesperson for the National Council of Resistance of Iran, an opposition alliance with a large network inside the country. The council is controversial, but its insights are still important.
In a nutshell, I can tell you a revolution has begun in Iran. That's how I would describe what's going on in Iran. Monday night was the 16th day, and despite a very, very ruthless, vicious crackdown, the protests and uprising continue. On Monday night, there were clashes within the people and the regime in several cities, like in Isfahan, in central Iran, in other parts of the country, in Kermanshah, west of Iran. In Tehran, there were clashes that we got reports of on Sunday evening and many, many neighborhoods. So despite the massive crackdown, the protests continue nationwide.
Revolution is, of course, a big word. And it is also the word people like Gobadi have been using and hoping for many, many years. The Mullah regime has been in power since 1979, when the Shah was overthrown. Ever since, the opposition has dreamed of its collapse. So it is understandable that someone like Gobadi uses this term. But we want to place that view next to a more sober analysis. That assessment comes from Walter Posch of Austria. He works at the Austrian Armed Forces National Defense Academy and is an expert on Iran's security apparatus.
Ja, ich glaube nicht, dass diese Proteste jetzt schlimmer oder härter oder umfangreicher sind als 2022.
I don't think these protests are any worse or harsher or bigger than 2022. Back then, they were already huge, really widespread. And of course, the biggest crisis was in 2009, and the regime survived that too. You mentioned the numbers, and as in all these conflicts, numbers get twisted all the time. Everyone counts differently, some out of desperation and anger, others out of political calculation, both on the government side and on the opposition side. And the dependence on the internet for images, that's also meant that we're basically blind now. Unlike before, when war correspondents could actually talk to people on the ground, take real personal risks, that's not really possible anymore. From what it looks like, or maybe it's already happening, the tide is turning. and the regime is acting very confidently, with a lot of self-assurance. There's nothing to suggest that these protests won't just fizzle out like all the others. But that doesn't mean it's a single victory or a clear, clean win for the regime.
Aber nicht heißt, dass es ein einziger Sieg oder ein glorreicher Tag für das Regime wäre.
That assessment sounds cautious, and deliberately so. It also sounds very different from what we've heard recently from Germany's Chancellor, Friedrich Merz. Merz was on a state visit to India, his first official trip to Asia, when he was asked about the protests in Iran. He said the brutal crackdown, with several hundred deaths and likely far more than 2,000 fatalities, some estimates even speak of 3,000, was an indication that the Mullah regime was close to collapse. Merz suggested the regime might have only days, perhaps weeks left. Walter Posch, the Iran expert from Austria, is clearly far more reserved. He assumes the regime remains relatively stable. To underline that contrast, let's turn back to the opposition, particularly on the scale and brutality of the crackdown. Let's talk about the numbers. As I mentioned, everything inside Iran is extremely blurry, especially since the internet was shut down last Thursday. Since then, very little has reached the outside world. There are a handful of videos circulating, apparently transmitted via Starlink connections, but verifying all of this is difficult, so the figures being cited must be treated with caution.
According to the information provided by the Network of the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, which is the biggest member of our coalition on the ground, until the January 11, at least 3,000 protesters have been killed by the regime. 3,000 protesters. This information comes from 195 cities throughout the country that have been involved in the protests. It comes from the hospitals. It comes from the local coroner's office. It comes from the relatives of the victims. So after an extensive research through the network of the People's Mujahideen, they announced that more than 3,000 protesters have been, as of now, definitely been killed. But despite this heavy, heavy crackdown, which to some extent is even difficult to imagine, the protests have been continuing, and we are still getting reports from Iran throughout the day.
All of this is understandable. I've said it before. The opposition, people like Shahin Gobadi, want the regime to fall. They believe the moment has come. But in fairness, we've heard this before. We heard it in 2022 and 2023 during the protests following the death of Jina Mahsa Amini. You'll remember a young Kurdish woman died after being arrested for allegedly wearing her headscarf incorrectly. That sparked nationwide protests that lasted for weeks and months. And back then, many observers also said, this is it. The Mullah regime is finished. But as we know today, that didn't happen. The regime survived. The same caution applies to claims of escalation. In recent days, only limited information has come out of the country. Regime-affiliated Telegram channels reported that protests had significantly declined. State television showed images of large pro-regime rallies. So the reality on the ground remains unclear. The opposition says the system is on the brink of collapse. That's expected. The expert urges caution, especially with numbers, and points to the regime's resilience. But Walter Posch also says something else. Every so-called victory comes at a price. And we shouldn't forget what happened just a few months ago. In June, there was a 12-day war with Israel. Israeli and U.S. air forces carried out heavy strikes on Iran's nuclear program. At the same time, Iran's so-called axis of resistance, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, suffered major blows. All of these groups had been armed and supported by Tehran. That weakened the regime. And as Posch puts it, every victory further erodes its foundations.
Vielmehr ist davon auszugehen, dass bei jedem dieser Proteste, der niedergeschlagen wurde,
actually, what we have to assume is that every one of these protests that gets crushed Sure, it's a victory, but it's a Pyrrhic victory. And at some point, you just can't afford Pyrrhic victories anymore. Not only has the regime's legitimacy already taken serious damage, starting really with 2009, the manipulated election that was all about getting Ahmadinejad into power, or their ideological defeat in 2022 during the Women, Life, Freedom protests. You can see it everywhere. The questions of legitimacy, they're already gone.
Aufgeben musste. Man sieht es überall, das sind, das sind Legitimitätssachen schon dahin. Die Leute wollen auch nicht mehr, agieren auch so, dass sie sagen, wir glauben nicht mehr an die Reformkräfte, wir glauben nicht mehr an die Reformierbarkeit des Regimes.
People no longer believe in reform. They no longer believe the system can be changed from within. If the figure of 3,000 deaths is even remotely accurate, it is a devastating toll. And it may not be entirely implausible. On the day of this recording, Tuesday, the regime itself acknowledged more than 2,000 deaths. Verified footage from a forensic institute shows rows of body bags with desperate relatives trying to identify their loved ones. There are also reports of mass arrests and fast-track trials, followed by executions. Officially, the authorities speak of rioters and terrorists. At the same time, state television broadcasts images of pro-regime demonstrations. Gobardi calls them staged.
Let me be very clear. These are all, as we say, state-managed. These are all, you know, state-organized protests. And despite all the regime's propaganda, I think these are desperate acts to boost the morale of the regime's forces, which are totally, totally dispirited. Because from all indications, they realize that the end of the regime is in sight. Obviously, the regime will go out of its way in propaganda, trying to prop up, as I said, the morale of its forces. But they saw that how protests spread throughout the country. They saw firsthand that how several generations have been involved in this protest. They realized that they had to resort to a massive, massive crackdown. And one has to keep in mind, when you kill that number of people in the streets, despite all of that, the regime's own forces realize how massive the protests are. So you're talking about the regime, which is basically, in my opinion, is on borrowed time. And these are quite evident. So the idea that the regime has popular support is gone a long time ago. The regime, which resorts to this kind of a massive, massive crackdown, realizes that this is a one-way street. And these are signs of a regime which is simply desperate for survival.
That claim also needs some context. Iran is a dictatorship, yes, but it is not a regime that rests on just one person, even though everything ultimately converges on Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The system stands on much broader pillars. There are the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a military force separate from the regular army, loyal only to Khamenei. Some call them an elite force. In reality, they have become a state within the state. Then there are the Basij militias, closely aligned with the regime. There are several intelligence services, and there is a security apparatus that has hardened over decades. This is important to understand. It's similar to what we've seen elsewhere, for example, in Venezuela. I recommend listening to our recent episode on that country, where U.S. forces recently carried out airstrikes and removed longtime ruler Nicolas Maduro. Back then, we also spoke to an expert about the resilience of the Venezuelan regime. The pattern is familiar. There are many people with a vested interest in the system's survival. In Iran, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, work in the public sector. Others are afraid, many are angry, but large parts of society still depend on the regime. That means removing one or two figures, whether Maduro in Venezuela or Khamenei in Iran, changes very little on its own. What is new, or at least particularly striking this time, is how these protests began. They started with the economy. At the end of December, the Iranian rial collapsed. It is now almost worthless. 10 million rials are worth roughly €8.60. That's practically nothing. And this is where it gets interesting. The first people to take to the streets were bazaar merchants in Tehran. Traditionally, they are seen as conservative. they are often considered pillars of the system. That they were the first to protest is highly unusual. At first it was about prices and economic hardship, but very quickly the protest turned political. Chants like "Death to the dictator" echoed through the streets. And that marks a rapid shift, faster than in 2022 or 2023. Gobardi also draws a clear distinction between what we are seeing now and the protests of recent years.
In terms of the how quickly it spread throughout the country, it spread to a matter of a few days to 195 cities and towns throughout the country. It began by a strike of the bazaaris, which are the backbone of the Iranian economy, but in a matter of a few hours, it spread throughout the whole, you know, first throughout Tehran, then other cities, and then it became nationwide in all 31 provinces. So that was one very clear, distinctive criteria for this uprising. The second one is the slogans of the people. It's very true that it started with on economic grievances, but very quickly it became done with dictator, done with Khamenei. This year is the year of the blood and Khamenei will be overthrown, and done with oppressor being the Shah or the supreme leader. So it clearly shows that people have a very clear vision about rejecting the regime in its in reality and rejecting any form of dictatorship in any shape or form, either previous one or the current one. Also, this time you had the composition of the protesters. You had merchants who are traditionally, as I said, middle class in Iran, who are becoming destituted because of this regime's policies. You had urban poor. You had intelligentsia in terms of academics and university people. So the composition is also very telling, that you have basically all the urban area composition involved. And most importantly, I think, is the courage of the Generation Z, Gen Z, that instead of just, you know, giving up when they were attacked by the regime, this time around they resisted. They fought back. I saw billboards in Tehran that were written big letters that said, "We are not going to cave in, we will fight back."
That is the opposition's perspective. It matters. But it is only one side. The question now is, what happens from the outside? Inside Iran, events are unfolding rapidly. From the outside, the rhetoric is heating up as well. Donald Trump has announced that he will take action, though with him, it is always unclear what that means. There is no doubt that the regime is shooting at protesters. The authorities openly admit to cracking down on what they call rioters and terrorists. Trump has repeatedly suggested that the United States might use military force. I do not believe that a large-scale U.S. attack on Iranian military or administrative targets is imminent. Not tomorrow, not right now. There simply aren't enough resources in the region for a full-scale operation. What is always possible, however, are symbolic strikes or targeted killings of regime figures. The U.S. has sufficient air power in the region for that. But both options would be extremely risky. Inside Iran, repression would likely intensify. Outside, retaliation would be almost certain. Iran has made it clear that if it is attacked, it will strike back, possibly against Israel, possibly against U.S. bases in the region. That could trigger a dangerous chain reaction. And there is another crucial question: what comes after? If the regime were to collapse, whether from internal pressure or external strikes, is there a plan for what follows? History in the region gives us plenty of warnings. Iraq, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iran's neighbor. In all of these cases, regime change, driven or accelerated from the outside, plunged countries into chaos. In Afghanistan, 20 years after the Taliban were overthrown, they are back in power. That is why the question of U.S. involvement is so sensitive. Iran expert Walter Posch put it this way when asked about Donald Trump.
Trump ist ein eigener Fall. Das ist hochinteressant, weil was er bis jetzt aufgeführt.
Trump is a whole different case. It's really interesting because what he's done so far, well, back in June, with that bombing and the Iranian counterattack, there were zero casualties. He makes threats, sure, but he also emphasizes, you can talk to us. You can talk to me. I don't see any troop buildup, nothing strategic on the ground. And, of course, the Americans can bomb any point in the world at any time. But that doesn't really achieve anything if the next day, Mr. Khamenei appears on TV and gives a stirring speech after the bombing. And those are the things Trump is thinking about.
Another important question is how Iran's neighbors are reacting, especially the Arab states. Saudi Arabia, for example, is often described as Iran's arch rival. The rivalry between Sunni-majority Saudi Arabia and Shiite Iran has shaped the region for decades. Yet, according to Posh, even the Saudis are not interested in a collapse of the Iranian state.
Im Allgemeinen gilt die Staaten, die dem Iran am meisten wehtun könnten, wären ja die Araber. Warum?
The states that could really hurt Iran the most would be the Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, for example. Saudi Arabia has indicated that they're not interested in destabilizing Iran. They'd rather have a self-focused but stable Iran, one whose influence in the region has been curbed, than see a regime collapse. The key thing is stability and reliable points of contact. And that, when you call from Riyadh, someone actually picks up the phone.
Mit dem man sich einigen kann, ist ihnen lieber so ein Regimesturz. Es ist ihnen sogar egal, ob da der Schah kommt, ob da eine Demokratie kommt oder wieder ein Mollah. Wichtig ist für diese Staaten Stabilität und dass man weiß, wenn man anruft, wenn man Probleme hat. Man will wissen, wer ist der Geheimdienstchef, man will wissen, wer ist der Generalstabschef und dass die das Telefon abheben, wenn man von Riyadh aus anruft.
And ultimately this is about the people of Iran. They do not want their country to become another Syria. They do not want state collapse. They do not want 14 years of war. Iran is a highly diverse country, ethnically and religiously. There are Kurds in the west, Baluch communities in the east, supporters of the National Council of Resistance, and others who still march with the flag of the former Shah. Some hope that Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah overthrown in 1979, might play a role in the future. There is no unified vision for what Iran should become. Kurds often advocate for a federal system. Among the Baluch, there are separatist tendencies. These competing ideas carry the risk of internal conflict, even civil war, and Walter Posch does not rule that out. Still, at the center of all this are people. That is why I wanted to hear something more personal from Shahin Gobadi. I asked him where he would go first if the regime were to fall. Gobadi has lived in exile in London for many years.
I will go to the place that the victims of this uprising and victims of the 1988 massacre are buried, because this is their revolution. This is what they fought for. When people talking about this guy coming to power, that guy coming to power, it's saddening for me because this whole thing belongs to the people who lost their lives for it. It's the story of a nation so heroically standing up for its dignity, for things that this is their right, a good life, a good future, equality, freedom. So I think the very first place I will go is to, if I be alive by that day, who knows, to go and tell them and make a commitment that I will do anything possible to make sure that their aspirations and their goals are safeguarded. They wanted freedom, they wanted democracy, they wanted an egalitarian society. They wanted a good future for every Iranian, and this is a commitment that we as a movement have made to them and me as a person. So that's my intention.
That explains why many people continue to demonstrate despite the danger. Many people are just fed up, really, with the regime. The regime is rigid, it's incapable of reform, it's obvious. The economic situation is terrible, and of course that leads to even more discontent. And the question is, what can these people actually achieve now? So, like I said, in 2022, 2023, a lot of observers thought, okay, now it's over for the regime. But it held on, it managed to consolidate its power. We're seeing again that it controls the flow of information in the country, the control over images, essentially. And it sends these loyal people out onto the streets. It complains about foreign interference, about the foreign orchestration of those protesting against the regime. And we've seen how harshly the protests are being crushed this time. The big question is, what happens next? In the short term, the system obviously holds. Security forces and networks of dependency work. Every protest that is crushed, though, as the Iran expert Posh told us, is a leader's victory, but a victory on an ever thinner foundation. The regime's legitimacy is definitely eroding. The problem now is that, with threats from the outside, for example, Americans saying they might intervene militarily, maybe with Israeli support, that actually reinforces the regime's narrative that the protests are foreign directed. So I think that's a very, very dangerous game the Americans are playing once again. In my view, there's almost no opposition group that explicitly calls for foreign intervention. The only one who occasionally suggests it is Reza Pahlavi, the son of the former Shah. But otherwise, everyone we talk to, whether Kurds, Baluchis, or Shia Persians, basically says, if there's going to be a revolution, it should come from the people themselves. That's how you avoid total collapse and try to guide Iran toward a democratic future. Now, as I said, the big question is, who would actually do that? What vision is there for the future? I don't see one, and neither do other observers. That's, of course, a huge problem. I hope, however, that somehow it will be possible to replace the Mullah regime, ideally through a smooth, mostly peaceful transition to democracy. For now, what really matters is getting reliable information about what's happening in the country, despite the internet shutdowns, protecting those at risk, and strengthening civil society, both inside Iran and in exile. I think it's important to stay grounded and not fall into the illusion, like Friedrich Merz seems to, that regimes can be toppled in a few days. That's the big danger, as we've already seen in Syria. Nobody wants that. It's a dilemma. Everyone wants to help the Iranians who risk their lives for democracy, for the overthrow of the Mullah regime. But the question is, what can be done from outside? In my view, staying informed, keeping pressure through sanctions, and avoiding military strikes is key. Military action would be counterproductive and would lead to uncontrolled collapse. And no one wants that. This was In Crisis Mode. This podcast is produced by Alexander Baumeister, a journalist from the Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, share it, and email us at krisenmodus@funkemedien.de. Take care of yourselves. See you next time. Bye-bye.